it. I'll just repeat, because I know some people joined us. Each side will have 15 minutes to argue. As counsel for appellant, you may reserve a portion of that. Would you like to reserve some for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
All right. You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Thomas Nesbitt. I'm counsel for Mr. Dacy Kim, the appellant in this case. This, as the Court no doubt is aware, is an appeal from the order of the Circuit Court of Fairfax County affirming a case decision by the Board of Accountancy that found Mr. Kim had violated a statute prohibiting anyone other than a firm that is licensed as a CPA firm as opposed to an individual from performing audits, and also for violating technical standards promulgated by the Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB, and the AICPA, American Institute for CPAs.
Do those standards apply to your client?
The standards absolutely do.
Okay, thank you.
You can see that in the context of this case that Mr. Kim was not qualified to engage in the professional services that he provided.
There's no question, and we've conceded this before the agency and the circuit court, and we'll do it again here, is that he should not have done an audit. He just didn't have a firm license. So with respect to that part of this case, the only thing that we are contesting is the nature of the penalties that were imposed on him for that part of the violation. The more, what I believe...
The $10,000 penalty.
Correct. And I think the court's probably aware, but just to reiterate points. So there's two $10,000 monetary penalties here. One for performing the audit without a firm license, and then one for what we view as a much more vague assertion that he has violated these broad body of standards in some way that we are not told how he did that. And there's really two layers. And what this gets to is the one issue that the circuit court actually addressed in its ruling from the bench, which when it said, without really elaborating, that under Virginia Code Section 2.2419A, that requires an agency to briefly and in writing explain the factual and procedural basis for its case decision. Circuit Court concluded that what it did was enough here. There are a couple of layers why Mr. Kim disagrees. First of all the board really said was he violated in some way general accepted accounting practices, generally accepted audit standards.
Can we move to the other one first?
Certainly, Your Honor.
The firm, if he was supposed to have a firm license.
Correct.
In order to do the auditing of this university. And he concedes he only done at most one or two of these.
That's
before.
Correct.
Given the fact that he had to have a firm license and he hadn't been participating in the peer review monitoring either, why is the $10,000 fine on this not a reasonable thing for the board to decide to do?
The problem we have with that is it appears to be grossly disproportionate to the sanctions the board's meted out in several cases over the past several years, I think going back to 2012, or the cases that we gathered and presented to the board. It's unclear whether the board actually considered those or the brief that was submitted between the informal fact-finding conference and the board's case decision. But be that as it may, the issue was raised. And if you look at the cases that there involve unlicensed activity, for instance, the only one that I believe comes even close, I think there was one other $10,000 monetary penalty, but it's somebody who was disbarred by the IRS, had been practicing after his license had already been revoked.
What is our standard of review as far as discerning whether or not the fine is appropriate or not?
Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't know that there's a finding. They just sort of said this is what the...
Which then takes me to my next question. It's our responsibility when boards and agencies and groups like this are specifically and duly authorized to conduct these kinds of reviews and evidentiary determinations and the like. It is our responsibility to defer to their determinations if there's a factual record or predicate to support it. And in this particular instance, the board decided that $10,000 fine was appropriate. If we were to come in and say, well, we looked at the record and we don't think it is appropriate, wouldn't we be substituting our view for that of the board?
Well, Your Honor, I think we need to be careful. One, if there's not an actual factual finding, we can't get to substantial evidence because we don't know what the evidence is supposed to substantiate.
Well, in this case, it's easy to substantiate the record. He's supposed to have certain qualifications. He didn't have those, and so therefore,
certainly,
easy case.
With respect to the finding that he violated that statute. I don't dispute that at all. The issue is what is squarely in front of the board is an argument that what is being recommended by the board member who presided over the informal fact-finding conference, a la $10,000 monetary penalty for practice for performing an audit without a firm license, is entirely disproportionate. So there are facts presented to the board. Now, it doesn't address them one way or the other. It doesn't say we're not persuaded by that.
Whenever we're talking about a penalty, typically, we're trying to accomplish two objectives, and this is the way I view penalties and the way that people impose penalties. Is number one, they're supposed to discourage the activities of the person who engaged in the inappropriate actions, and two, discourage others who may follow from engaging that action. Mm-hmm. And if there's a situation where people know that if I don't have the proper certification, authorization, and the like, I can be on the hook for a $10,000 fine. Isn't that some sort of discouragement and the type of thing that a penalty can accomplish?
Certainly. That's an objective of any kind of punitive system, one of. The issue is that when there is really, it's hard to unmarry this from the other issue here of the lack of a factual finding of any kind of other than one that we certainly can see exists, that he didn't have a license.
And he didn't participate in peer review monitoring. Right?
And I don't want to get into too... This is an argument we raised and didn't flesh out because I don't think it's sort of subsidiary. You know, if we really look at what the statute requires about peer review, it applies to a firm. He's not a firm. So I'm not sure that he really... is required to do that, but...
Mr. Tesley, your second assignment of error is that your client was not on notice of what the board was considering. But this was an audit of one transaction, was it not?
It was an audit of thousands of transactions.
Well, I meant it was one client.
True.
Okay, so and your client responded, did he not, to this? I mean, obviously, it was thousands of transactions, but it was one client. So, what notice was lacking to your client when we say we're doing an audit of the, I can't remember the name of the corporation or and here's what we're concerned about, and your client responds to it? What didn't he know?
Well, a couple of things, Your Honor. First of all, if we look at the text of the actual informal fact-finding conference notice, it's not really clear what they're talking about. They're saying answer to something about tax evasion. Well, there's not any allegation or evidence that he even prepared a tax return for this organization. There's an allegation one of the issues that's laid out in the informal fact-finding conference notice is... there's an allegation, incidentally not in the complainant's complaint to the board, that he misrepresented or fabricated fraudulent financial statements. Well, he didn't prepare any financial statements. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that he did. Indeed, he was hired to do an audit that, granted, he shouldn't have been doing, but that's exactly the opposite of preparing a financial statement. It's reviewing it. That's just the informal fact-finding conference notice. Now, that's attached, and what my client was received from the board and was called upon to respond was a copy of this complaint that was filed that includes allegations that he engaged in some kind of impropriety with respect to a state corporation commission filing, which has nothing to do with this board. And there were two things that actually had to do with the audit, that he didn't take an adequate sample size of certain banking transactions and that he didn't gather a sufficient or appropriate supporting documentation with regard to some personal loan from the president or ostensible president of the organization. And yet what this turned into, now I'm speculating here because the board didn't tell us. They didn't tell us what they found that he did wrong. But it seemed to have turned into this sort of dragnet approach of, well, they're calling upon Mr. Kim to come in and disprove or prove that he did not violate every conceivable violation of these thousands of pages of technical standards promulgated by FASB and AICPA. That's not enough to marshal an intelligent defense.
Of what did he have not done notice?
What the board, what the subjects that would be considered at the informal fact-finding conference would be, other than broad through this massive scope of, you may have violated one of thousands of different technical standards, one or more. So the problem is, how is he supposed to come in and prepare a reasonable accounting for himself, no pun intended, when there's this vagueness, and indeed there's an inconsistency with what was presented to him. We don't know really what this board member who presided over the informal fact-finding conference was interested in, because if it all went back to whatever was in the notice and the complaint that was given to my client to which he responded, and they made a finding that you didn't take enough, your sample size was too small.
Well, the genesis for this was the complaint from the university that came from Mr. J. Kim.
Correct.
Right? And so he certainly had a an indication, given that Mr. Kim had filed numerous complaints and was even making allegations that somehow your client had been involved in enabling people on their board to embezzle money and that sort of thing. So he at least knew that it was related to that, the auditing of the statements of that university, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So I guess, to follow up on Judge Haley's question, what specifically, I mean, just because the board, and I'll have some questions for the board on this, said, okay, you violated all these standards, and there are thousands of pages of standards, he still knew that this related to this university and the auditing of it that he did when he knew his firm was not licensed to do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My point is that related to isn't enough. He needs to have more specific information about what he's going to be called upon to answer. And
I don't want to make you go into your...
Certainly. Thank you, Your Honor. I will do that.
Right. Thank you, Mr. President. Good morning.
Good morning, yeah. May it please the court, I'm Anna Birkenhire here today on behalf of the Virginia Board of Accountancy. This matter involves a licensed CPA in the Commonwealth of Virginia who was not licensed to offer audit services to the public, but nonetheless accepted an engagement to perform an audit for a not-for-profit educational institution. And while Mr. Kim informed the client that he would perform this audit in compliance with accounting standards and audit standards accepted in the United States, he then prepared an audit that failed to comply with those standards. The client.
Can I take you to that? Because I hate to interrupt you, but time goes by so fast on these arguments. I'm going to take you to page 280 of the Joint Appendix. And this is the board's final decision, final opinion and order, as it says, in the Board of Accountancy. And number three there, of what it goes through, it says, Kim shall pay a monetary penalty of $10,000 within 90 days of the entry date of the order for the noncompliance with technical standards issued by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, which is generally accepted auditing standards, and the Financial Accounting Standards Board, generally accepted accounting principles. It's been a long time since I was in accounting at William & Mary, but that is very, very general, isn't it? How does that say what he really violated? There are no specific examples. You violated, 2.1-C, or you violated this, or a description of it. It's just he violated the generally accepted accounting principles and the generally accepted auditing standards, but not any specific indication where or how.
Certainly, Your Honor. I do believe it's important to note, there's a difference between what's required under 2.2 4019 of the Administrative Process Act, which requires a general brief and written statement of the board's finding, in comparison to what's laid out in the record, which is an extended dialogue between Mr. Kim and the presiding officer at the hearing, wherein the hearing officer took Mr. Kim basically page by page through the audit, raising issues that did not comply with the technical standards.
And certainly Mr. Bradshaw, who's the chairman of the board, right?
He has served as that, yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
He's not currently the chair. He previously
was. He was at this point in time. So he took him through and said, oh, you know you can't do this. I mean, he told him about lubrifications. You definitely can't do this and so forth. But in the actual order, an opinion, it doesn't say any of that. So how do we know that that's what the board, which is and the board didn't do everything Mr. Bradshaw suggested. They did some other things too, like revoking his license for at least 5 years. So how do we know, given what's in writing is so general, why does that deserve, why should we affirm a $10,000 penalty based on that?
Right. Well, Your Honor, I think, again, there is, you know, as the circuit court noted, this is certainly a general order that the board issued. It's important to consider that in the context of the evidence, and there's certainly substantial evidence to demonstrate that Mr. Kim failed to comply with these standards. And there were specific references to standards in the IFF proceeding. You know, certainly there could have been more information included in the board order, specific citations to various accounting standards or under either the AICPA or the FASB guidelines. But the APA simply does not require, you know, that much detail necessarily, especially where in a case
like being told, well, you committed, I know it's not a crime, this is a civil matter, but, you know, you violated the Code of Virginia, so we're going to, let's put it on the civil side, so therefore we're going to assess this fine against you.
I do think there's a distinction to a certain extent. I think the generally accepted standards, both for accounting and for auditing, are intrinsic. You know, you need to be familiar with the entire document to understand how it's similar to a tax preparer needing to be familiar with the Internal Revenue Code. Not every scenario may apply to each, you know, tax statement that you're preparing, but if you're unfamiliar with certain parts of it, you're unable to identify what needs to be done. And there are certain dialogues in the IFF where Mr. Bradshaw addresses, you know, you do not need to provide this type of information for a not-for-profit audit, so you should be classifying it as supplementary information or that type of, you know, conversation.
My concern, I guess, and I'll just throw this at it, is that it doesn't really tell him exactly what the board, as opposed to Mr. Bradshaw, the fact finder, former fact finder, acting at that point, I guess, for the agency. It doesn't tell him what they found him in violation of specifically, other than generally accepted accounting principles.
I do think it's relevant to note that the board did adopt the presiding officer's report and recommendation. They didn't modify his factual findings. They did modify the recommended sanctions imposed on Mr. Kim.
Even that is rather general, isn't it? When you look at what the informal, that's on page 282 of the joint appendix of what was issued by the informal fact-finding conference report. It's also rather general about the violated the very generally accepted accounting principles and auditing principles. Does it say more than that?
So, no, it is also a fairly brief statement. Again, I would point to 2.24019 subsection A on that point. I think it's relevant also perhaps to step back a bit. In light of the record here and Mr. Kim's admissions, throughout the IFF hearing, Mr. Kim admitted he was unfamiliar with certain technical requirements.
He admitted he was unfamiliar with a lot of things.
Right, and I think in that, this is not a situation where Mr. Kim has stated, you know, I don't believe I violated the standards, but I don't know which standards I need to prepare my defense
sort of
for.
His lawyers is telling us and told the circuit court too, I thought.
And I do think that to a certain extent he is making that claim, but at the same time, you know, at the IFF hearing, counsel for Mr. Kim stated that he had no questions about the IFF notice and that he was prepared to address Mr. Kim's compliance with the technical standards for an audit. So, it would appear from that statement that Mr. Kim provided the defense that he anticipated to provide at the IFF for his compliance. So I think to the extent that the board's language is fairly general here, the IFF report going through page by page the various elements of the audit and raising each, you know, technical requirement and asking Mr. Kim if he had any, if he was aware of the requirements that he didn't follow or had any justification.
To follow up on Judge Beals' question, what would be wrong with this court remanding this case to the board, saying that there are certain requirements that need to be met, you have not met them? We can speculate as to, and this sort of throwing my own language, I speculate as to your reasons why, but you have not met the requirements of the procedures, so therefore we're going to remand with instruction to provide a factual record and then dismiss if appropriate. What would be wrong with that? So that we can make sure that things are done in a proper way down the road.
That is certainly within this court's authority. And I think, you know, the record demonstrates that the circuit court judge asked a similar question, and we had a discussion of that. And I think he ultimately concluded that under 2.24019, this order was sufficient, but I think that is
certainly... But I think the purpose, and I'm nowhere near the expert in this that you are, but the purpose in this is that we don't have rubber stamping of allegations. In other words, we want to make sure that there are findings supporting the allegations that are made, as opposed to just letting the allegations support the decisional process.
Certainly, and I think had the board simply accepted the allegations raised in the complaint and included those, for example, in the IFF report and the ultimate board order, that would demonstrate that type of, rubber stamping process. The board and the hearing officer and the board, did not adopt all of the allegations, didn't investigate all the allegations raised in the complaint, and narrowed it down to the issues that were before their jurisdiction. And especially in light of Mr. Kim's acknowledgement that there was a due care issue here in his performance of the audit, and that he was not as familiar as he should have been, perhaps, with the relevant standards, I think, the board certainly had a demonstrated record that satisfied that lack of compliance with these standards.
Can I shift it just a little bit? The informal fact-finding conference report that was chaired by Mr. Bradshaw and his recommendations to the board talked about penalties, fines, various other things, but did not mention anything that I'm aware of, and correct me if I'm wrong, about his CPA license, his personal CPA license being revoked. So he goes into the Board of Accountancy meeting with that. I mean, I guess anything's possible that could come out of a meeting, but with not any sort of warning, if you will, or perhaps notice that his CPA license might be revoked. And the board then, in the first item in its opinion, its order, is Kim's individual CPA license shall be placed on suspension for a period of no less than 5 years from the entry date of this order. And then it goes on to indicate that it's at least 5 years. Upon completion of the 5-year period, Kim will be required to come before the board to demonstrate his competency prior to the consideration of any applications for reinstatement of CPA licensure in Virginia. So it's revoked, really, not just suspended, and it's for at least 5 years. Now, clearly the board has authority to do this, but where is the notice that going into this, given that Mr. Bradshaw never raised this, and all of a sudden now he not only can't do things he shouldn't have been doing before, like the audit that he's only firms are supposed to do, but now he can't even do things that a CPA, individual CPA, can do.
Certainly. Your Honor, I would draw your attention to page 126 of the Joint Appendix, which is the letter that Mr. Kim received with the presiding officer's report in advance of the board hearing on this matter. And that notice makes Mr. Kim aware of the fact that the board has the authority to amend, accept, or reject the presiding officer's recommendation. So that constitutes a notice that the recommendations
include... Does it say anything about your license might be?
It does not, Your Honor, but that is one of the authorities that the board has pursuant to statute. To the extent that Mr. Kim was made aware that the board could modify it,
It said, we may impose any penalties authorized by law to impose. Here it focuses that the board may amend, that's true, accept or reject the presiding officer's recommendation. This was not in his recommendations at all. And as my understanding of the board meeting is that his counsel did get to argue to the board, but for only about 5 minutes, and it was really not a lot of, not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with that, I'm just saying if this is what it's said is likely to happen, amend, accept, or reject, and it's not even in there, and it's nothing saying, well, you know, be prepared, you know, your license might be, or even just, we can do anything we're allowed to do by law, it focuses on the presiding officer's recommendation. And so how does he have noticed that he's about to lose his CPA license?
Well, he didn't have notice specifically that he may lose his license, but he did have notice that the board had the authority to amend the presiding officer's report. And I think especially to the extent that Mr. Kim provided, you know, had done a thorough review of other cases involving this, it was something that I imagine he would have been aware of with falling within the board's authority. It's a clear statutory authority that the board holds. And so I think that was something that notice sufficiently would have made him aware of. The, you know, I would just like to make a few additional...
Yeah,
oh, no.
I've asked a lot of questions.
The board would take the position that this court should affirm the circuit court's order for three primary reasons. The first is that Mr. Kim received clear due process throughout this entire procedure, including statutorily sufficient notice of the alleged violations. The notice of the IFF did, in fact, specifically address the audit he prepared for CalUMS. He attended the IFF, and at the IFF stated that specifically that he had no questions regarding the IFF notice. You can find that language on pages 135 to 137 of the joint appendix. On page 138 of the joint appendix, at the IFF again, counsel for Mr. Kim stated that they were prepared to provide specific information regarding Mr. Kim's compliance with the technical standards for an audit. Furthermore, you know, the scope of issues before the board and the presiding officer at the IFF were made aware to Mr. Kim. To the extent that there was any confusion, I think Mr. Kim's presentation at the IFF demonstrates that that would be harmless error at most. Although we certainly don't concede there was any error with respect to the IFF notice. Again, the board's case decision does provide a brief and general written notice of the factual or procedural basis for its decision as required by 2.2.40.19 subsection A of the Administrative Process Act. And especially where Mr. Kim provided an engagement letter found at page 46 of the joint appendix and an audit report found at page 14 to the client, which noted that this audit would be prepared in compliance with auditing standards accepted in the United States of America. It's clear that he was on notice and understood that there were these standards that applied to this type of audit. Additionally, all sanctions imposed by the board were within the statutory authority, as was mentioned a bit earlier, and reflected the...
There's nothing that's outside the board's authority.
No, and I would draw attention to the court's attention to pages 83 to 96, of the joint appendix. There's an extended list of similar findings for unlicensed practice or expired licenses. So on that basis, Your Honor, we take the position that Mr. Kim has certainly failed to meet his burden to show error or to demonstrate that any error was anything more than harmless. And on that basis, we would ask this court to affirm the circuit court's order.
Thank you. Mr. Nesbitt, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few things. Just to touch on the penalty issue that came up during counsel's argument, and we spent a lot of time earlier talking about the monetary penalty, but the license suspension, I think, is of critical importance here. One thing I would just point out is if we look at the board's order, it's tying violations to penalties. So you perform an audit you're not supposed to do, you get a $10,000 penalty. You violate these standards, whatever they may be, $10,000 penalty. License suspension, 5 years. Not specifically associated with anything.
You don't dispute the board's authority to do so. You're just saying that...
It is within the bounds of the sanctions that the General Assembly has authorized it to impose. The issue we have... The position Mr. Kim takes is that the board has applied its discretion in an arbitrary fashion, which it does not have the authority to do. But certainly, $10,000, they can fine somebody up to $100,000 for one violation. They can do that.
And you did address the board at their meeting.
Correct.
Did you feel you were prepared to address the issue in case they decided to revoke his CPA license?
No, not at all. And one thing I would just point out is on page 63 of the joint appendix, and I acknowledge counsel's argument about, yes, there was this statement that the board could modify in however it wanted to Mr. Bradshaw's recommendations. But if we put ourselves in Mr. Kim's shoes, going all the way back to the informal fact-finding conference notice, and this is all part of one adjudicative process, page 63 of the appendix, third of the way down the page, it says, after consideration of all information, the board may, one, exonerate you, two, impose a monetary penalty pursuant to 54.14413.4, and or three, offer a final order with other terms and conditions the board deems appropriate. Now, I suppose revoking or suspending his license for 5 years is other terms. But when there's this level of specificity, and then this sort of comes out of left field at him, I would argue that he hasn't had sufficient notice of what the sanction may be. And again, I think that given that it's not tied to any particular violation, it appears to be arbitrary.
That is the major difference between the IFSC report and recommendations and what the board does, right?
Yes, that's the most significant and really only substantive difference.
Yeah, just one quick question.
Yes, sir.
You don't dispute the $250 penalties because of the lack of CPE?
No, not at all.
Okay. All right. We appreciate
Thank you,
argument by both counsel. We agree, counsel.